From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1884 during the semicentennial for the city of Rochester. Judge Charles Fitch was memorializing Nathaniel Rochester, the city's founder. Fitch wanted the crowd to know that Nathaniel Rochester moved north because, quote, he could not bear the thought of rearing his family amid the demoralizing influences, end quote. Fitch was talking about more southern states and presumably the horrific practice of slavery. That's part of the lore. Well, this story is recounted in a piece of reporting this week from the Democrat and Chronicle's Justin Murphy. He wanted to take a look at the differences between narrative and fact when it comes to Rochester, but not just Nathaniel Rochester. As Murphy explains, the founders of many local towns and institutions owned enslaved people and engaged in deeply racist practice. Some of those familiar names include Fitzhugh, Charles Carroll, Hopkins, Williamson, Morris, Pulteney, Gates, Henrietta, Penfield, and yes, of course, Rochester. Justin Murphy writes, quote, 210 years ago, Nathaniel Rochester left Maryland for New York. Traveling in his caravan were his wife, his children, and 10 black people whom he'd held in slavery. Recent research based on original Rochester family documents held at the University of Rochester establishes that Nathaniel Rochester brought enslaved black people with him to New York, both for his own personal service and to rent out for additional income, end quote. Which brings us to the current debate regarding what to do about all of this. Some activists have called for removing the names of racist founders from parks, from buildings, even from town and city names. There's a wide range of opinions on this, even among activists and those who have worked for change. This hour, we explore the history and address some of that debate. Our guests include Justin Murphy, a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle, whose work is the seed for this discussion. Outstanding as always. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Evan.
Bill Johnson is the former mayor of the city of Rochester and co-chair of the recently formed Commission on Racial Equity. Mayor Johnson, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be with you, Evan.
Victoria Schmidt is with us. She's a local historian. Victoria, welcome to the program. Do we have Victoria? We're going to see if we do. She might be on mute, might be on our end. I'm going to say hello to Justin Barron, chair of the history department at SUNY Geneseo and author of the book Reconstructing Democracy, Grassroots Black Politics in the Deep South After the Civil War. Justin, welcome back to the program.
Great. Thanks to be with you, Evan.
Well, Justin Murphy, I want to start with you because I know you're working on a book and you might have a better sense than many Rochesterians and people from Western New York about the history. But generally speaking, what do you think the narrative has been about Nathaniel Rochester, slavery, his ownership of enslaved people? What do you think the narrative has been, you know, leading up to what we are talking about today?
Well, I think that it's been mute. I think that some minority of people could probably tell you that Nathaniel Rochester came from the South and that he owned slaves in some, you know, purportedly benign way. But I think that what's missing is, not only the fact that he may have personally held a whip in his hand at some point and kind of the lurid way that we think about it, but the way that the finance of the purchases underpins not just his actions, but really the entire land transaction history of the entire western part of New York. I think that, you know, none of the documents and the information that I brought out here were buried all that deeply, but it has just never really been put together in one place before.
We're going to talk to the historians on the panel about what we do know and how we know it in just a moment. But Mayor Johnson, when you were the mayor of the city of Rochester, how much of that history were you aware of? How much do you think Rochesterians were aware of? And how much do you think, at least at the time, that people cared about that?
I was not as aware of the history as mayor as I became when I joined the faculty of RIT. And I taught a course on Rochester politics, people, and places. And therefore, we immersed ourselves in the history of the city of Rochester from its beginning until the current day. I want to add another perspective. I'm probably the only person in this group who was born in the South. And even if you were born as a white person in the South, you had a hell of a different perspective than I did as being a black person in the segregated South. Not only that, I was born in a place called Lynchburg, Virginia. And for the longest time, the narrative was that the concept of lynching derived from Lynchburg, Virginia. Lo and behold, doing a little bit of research, we discovered the founder of Lynchburg was John Lynch, who was a Quaker and an abolitionist. He had nothing to do with lynching. So I think that we need to understand history. I think Justin has done a great service in not only this piece, but in the other pieces that he's written. But we cannot change history. And I am of the opinion, as I'm now beginning to refer to myself as a liberated, oppressed person, as one who has grown up in that system of oppression, who experienced it firsthand, I know that there are better things to do with our time than wondering what to do about the names of Rochester, Fitzhugh, Putney, and all of the rest of them. Because practically every white man in America in the 19th century owned slaves. We can't change that. That is just an absolute fact of life. What did they do with their lives? Okay? One thing Justin didn't put in his article was this. In addition to founding the city of Rochester, Nathaniel Rochester also founded the St. Luke's Episcopal Church, the oldest church in the city of Rochester, in the oldest building in the city of Rochester. That was his home church. Do I worry about going to that church because Nathaniel Rochester founded it? No. Guess what? It is the only integrated church in the city of Rochester. It was formed, is now the St. Luke's and the St. Simon of Cyrene Episcopal Church in downtown Rochester. The merger of a black church and a white church. It is the first church to openly welcome gay people in the city of Rochester. So I'm not worried about what Nathaniel Rochester did in the 19th century. I'm not worried about the fact that he founded that church. What I marvel about is what that church is doing today. And we need to stop focusing so much on trying to change the past and change the present and the future.
Well, here's an example, I think, of the confusion that people have had about Nathaniel Rochester, and this is where I want to first bring in Victoria Schmidt. Charles writes to the program and says, Evan, I appreciate what your guests are saying, but my understanding has always been that, yes, Nathaniel Rochester owned slaves, but not when he moved north, not when he was here. And that's important to point out, too. Okay, Victoria Schmidt, that's what Charles says, but again, that's not what we are understanding now. Is that right?
Well, I completely agree with Mayor Johnson, because there are so many.
We lost you for a second, Victoria. Are you still there?
City.
Oh, there you are. I'm sorry, Victoria. We lost you for a second. Go ahead.
Okay. I agree with Mayor Johnson's point of view perspective that, yes, we must honor the many African Americans who have made Rochester a national center of reform in the 19th century. We were just as important as Atlanta became with the civil rights movement in the 60s in the South. And we don't teach this in American history. We don't teach children that our nation was founded and our capitalist system was founded by enslaved people. It's all on their backs. They did build this country. And so we should be honoring that. We should be celebrating that. That should be the theme for our city. center of reform. We have the sites, we have the collections, we have the people. And other places are proud of their history. We've covered it up so well that when we start to find out these things, it goes right back to the Declaration of Independence. And who did they blame in the first draft? The King of England. It was all his fault. He was the mean person that killed all those people on the Middle Passage and sent them all over the world. We can't keep teaching this stuff to our kids. We have to tell them the truth. And Rochester, with all the history and the people and the inspiring reformers that have happened here, their name should be just as famous as Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. That's how I feel about it. And there's cultural heritage tourism, there's business branding, there's so many things we could be doing here to make ourselves a center of what's good about America.
Let me turn to Justin Berend and ask if you agree with historian Victoria Schmidt when she said that for a long time we have been teaching kids a sort of a whitewashed version of history, and so that's why we have emails like Charles. I'm not trying to disparage the emailer, but when Charles says, no, my understanding was Nathaniel Rochester, well, he didn't have enslaved people when he moved north, which turns out not to be true. It's almost like these narratives that we really want to believe that would feel better to believe, Justin. Do you agree with Victoria on that point?
Yeah, I think Victoria makes a really good point about the way that we're teach a particular version of history, one that's aspirational in a way, and maybe not one that's fully invested in the truth of the past. One of the things that I noticed in teaching at SUNY Geneseo, almost all of my students are from the state of New York, and very few of them come into my classes knowing that slavery was legal in New York, even up to 10 years after the founding of the Constitution, and then the gradual abolition law took another few decades to kind of work itself out. And so enslaved people are living in New York well into the early part of the 19th century in a supposedly free state. And so we use terms like free state that often erase the experiences of individuals like Austin Stewart, who was written about by Justin Murphy and also by Victoria Schmidt. So we have to understand that the struggle for freedom and equality is often best explained through the struggle of the enslaved and for other Black people in American history. And I think articles like Justin really helped to kind of point how we should be understanding the more darker aspects of our historical past. The unseemly aspects of our past, because we can't fully address the inequalities today, I think, without understanding those distant legacies.
And Justin, before the program began, Victoria told me that her work is as a historian. It's not to decide if names should come down off of buildings or parks or even cities themselves. Do you take that point, or do you have a position on names?
I think it would be helpful to kind of think about renaming schools and parks, streets. I think names reflect the values of our society, and we should rethink how things are named and what our values are right now. As a kind of a counterpoint to that, another way to think about it, when the Confederate monuments went up in the South, in the late 19th century, so 1890s and early part of the 20th century, that was the exact same time that Southern state legislators were enacting Jim Crow legislation. So they married a repressive policy with repressive monuments and architecture. And if we invert that and think about the ways that we want to create a more of an anti-racist society, a more equality-based society, then our symbols, our monuments, our names, I think, should reflect that.
All right.
Go ahead, Victoria. Excuse me if I could interrupt 1 second, because I'm a material culture specialist, so I deal with tangible evidence, whether it's a sculpture or a document. And it's possible. I mean, for example, I used to give tours of Mount Hope Cemetery. And my tours would start with when the founders wrote the Declaration of Independence and they said all men were created equal. Did they mean everybody in America? And I can guarantee you most people answer yes, adults and children, because that's what we are indoctrinated with, and we're even tested on our indoctrination. That's why all these standardized tests, all they tell you is who has a good memory. And we would discuss the fact that, no, it only meant white men who owned property originally. But you can tell more of a story because, let's say, but you have to know the history and you've got to know the culture. For example, the Washington Monument, I find that an absolutely fascinating subject because it's in the form of an obelisk. And what was an obelisk? It was an African art form to honor the sun god. How ironic is that? So it might not be a matter of changing the name. It might be a matter of reinterpreting. But we have to know the facts in order to reinterpret.
Sure, I take that.
And we have to start teaching kids critical thinking skills instead of memorizing and spitting back on a test.
Well, so Justin Murphy, this is the kind of, here's another email. This is the kind of email I keep getting. Michael says, Evan, I read a lot of local history 40 and 50 years ago. What I remember reading is that Nathaniel Rochester came here with slaves but freed them when he got here. Is that true or not true? Justin Murphy, for what I hope would be a definitive time, one more time, Justin Murphy.
No, it's certainly not true, and that's evidence, among other things, from census records, which show in 1800, 1810, 1820, Nathaniel Rochester listed enslaved people on his own household census form. There are also documents at the University of Rochester, his family papers that Victoria Schmidt and city historian Christine Radarski wrote a very thoughtful article about a decade ago, with where he is, for instance, collecting rent on an enslaved person who he let out to somebody in 1826, which is only a few months before slavery was finally abolished in New York. So to kind of throw in with the historians here, there's two separate questions. The renaming question is, maybe immaterial. Whether we call it Fitzhugh Street or Douglas Street is not, at the end of the day, going to change anybody's life. But your emailer who said he heard that version of Nathaniel Rochester's history, that's actually probably a lot more than most people learn in schools. I think that the version of local history that most people learn in schools is we built the Erie Canal, Frederick Douglass freed the slaves, Susan B. Anthony freed the women, George Eastman invented the camera, and Nick Tahoe invented the garbage plate. End of
yeah,
list.
That's about right.
And so
to connect that to what Bill's saying, Bill is absolutely correct that if his commission finishes up and says we've decided to rename Fitzhugh Street, that would be extremely disappointing. But one of the key sources of pushback to the kind of substantive work that his commission will be doing is people not appreciating the depth and historical gravity of slavery and other forms of racist discrimination in the country. So it's through things like this that you can ideally, and if it's possible to persuade people anymore, make them realize that there is, in fact, a significant wrong that needs to be righted today, not 200 years ago.
Bill Johnson, do you want to respond?
And you're exactly, it's imperative because we have children coming up. We can't keep telling them the same stuff. It causes shame. We've had a Holocaust in this country, first with indigenous people and then with people of color. And I've been doing a lot of praying for forgiveness. since George Floyd died, because as much as I've known that about the past, as a historian, that visceral experience of watching a man suffer and beg for 4.5 minutes on television made me realize that I am a privileged person that gets to get up every single day and not worry about being shot by a police officer because I'm white.
So let me.
That's pretty serious.
Yeah, so let's let Bill Johns for a second. There's a lot there. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah. I appreciate this conversation. It's necessary. It's very complicated. There's been a lot of miseducation that's going on, a lot of false information that has been embedded in our consciousness. I mean, Victoria just alluded to Native Americans. We haven't even talked about the fact that the whole narrative is that this piece of land that we now call the United States of America was just sitting here as a wilderness, not populated, and it took Europeans to come here and discover this place, which is absolutely untrue. And yet we are informed about Native Americans by movies that we saw as children, that they were hostile people, that they only existed to keep white people from trying to populate and civilize this nation. We've got a lot of miseducation to correct, and that's a massive undertaking, okay? But let me just say this. When you begin to do research, you understand things. Now, I have watched white people, lips quiver, their whole body palpitate when you say to them, do you believe that Black Lives Matter? I watched Vice President Pence a few Sundays ago. He literally almost had a stroke on television because he could not get those three words off of his lips. I believe all lives matter. I believe I'm a fundamentalist Christian. I believe in the right to life. Yes, sir. But do you believe Black Lives Matter? Now, let me tell you why that is an important question. That is an important question. Because we've just been alluding to it. Justin's work alludes to it. The professor's teaching alludes to it. Victoria's work alludes to it. We have treated a whole race of people as though they did not exist or they did not matter. Their lives were worthless. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Their lives were worthless. They were slaves. And when freedom was granted by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and the Civil Rights Act of 1866, those people, my ancestors, still had to fight, plead, beg for the rights that were written on paper. We spent another 100 years of Jim Crow. And even after Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, all right, I was a sixth grader sitting in public schools in the city of Lynchburg, Virginia, when that decision was announced on May 17th, 1954, all children should go to school together. Guess what? It took the South 10 years before they even began to comply, because the court came back in 1955 and said, you should move with all deliberative speed, deliberative, not deliberate. Look up the meaning and the difference of the word. Now, what am I getting to? There is a famous Supreme Court decision in 1857, the Dred Scott case, Dred Scott versus Sanford. Chief Justice Roger Taney, who, by the way, owned slaves, when deciding the fate of Dred Scott, who had moved from the South, from a slave state to a free state, and according to the Missouri Compromise, when that happened, you were freed. You became a freed man. The issue was litigated. Chief Justice Taney wrote, a Negro can never have the rights of citizenship. And guess what he said? A Negro has no rights. No, no. A Negro has no rights, which a white man is bound to respect. That is the entire ideology of the white supremacist movement that we are dealing with today. No rights, which a white man is bound to respect. Now, let me say to you, when we began to start framing our discussion around real things like that, here's something I think needs to be revisited from the past. I think we need to go back and scrub that language out and make an assertion, all right? A black man has no rights which a white man can disrespect. Now we get to the root cause of the problem. And I will tell you this. I will tell you this. I've seen it in my work at the Urban League. I've seen it in my work as mayor. I've seen it in classrooms. I just taught a class at St. John Fisher on the law and public policy last fall. And we were looking at issues like bail reform and disparities. And I had a class of mature, middle management people. Every time, who were predominantly white, there was one African-American in that class. And every single time we talked about race, those highly intelligent people could not articulate one thought. They wanted to move on to something else because their comfort level was being disturbed. I had a friend of mine, I'm going to shut up over this point, in Rochester. I'm going to disclose something that I try to keep from the media. I wrote a letter in June to my white friends. I don't think of people as white and black. I truly don't. But I was sitting here at home, isolated. I couldn't go out into the demonstrations. I'm not going into any crowds with any people. What can I do? What based on my history? So I wrote a letter, and I went through my email list, and I found 150 white people who I could consider friends, colleagues, and associates. And I sent them a 5-page letter. And I said to them, I know this letter is long, but I ask you as my friend and as your friend to read it. And I ask you to watch 3 videos that are attached. If you want to understand white privilege, I want you to watch every second of those videos. Okay? I'll tell you exactly what the videos were. The woman in Central Park who threatened to call the police on an African-American man, okay? The second video was a woman in New Jersey. You saw the case who came upon a scene where her daughter had been detained by the police for a traffic violation, and she ended up using profanity. She told 2 white police officers, F yourself. She didn't say F yourself. She used all 4 letters of the word.
Yeah.
Okay? And that lady was allowed to get in her car and drive away. And I don't know of any time and place in America where a black person could tell a police officer to F yourself and they would still be able to walk away free. All right? And the third, and here's the thing, that police officer spent 66 minutes at the scene of that incident for a traffic violation, waiting for her to come and get her, because they had to confiscate the car. They had to impound the car. The car was not licensed, wasn't insured, and these 4 white PhD students are riding around illegally in this car. So they impounded it, waited for her to come and pick them up so that they would not be further inconvenienced. And the third video I attached ran for 3 minutes and 33 seconds. It was Philando Castile being confronted by police officers in the suburbs of Minneapolis over a traffic violation. And within 3 minutes of that confrontation, he was dead, shot 4 times by a policeman because he told them he had a licensed gun to carry. The Second Amendment didn't mean anything, was of no benefit for Philando Castile, okay? Now, I said, watch all of that, and then we'll talk. I have been getting amazing responses from the people. I've sent out 65 of those letters to my friends, and I've been getting amazing responses, all right? But let me tell you one response. I'm going to shut up and I'm going to be finished because this is so important to the work that we're talking about. Let me tell you a response I got. One, a person called me who is a white woman married to a black man. They are dear friends of mine. I know the family. It's one of the most famous families in Rochester, okay? And they were having a discussion about Black Lives Matter. And one of her siblings said to her, and this is a very close-knit family, I have socialized with these people for years. One of her siblings said, we don't want to talk about this anymore. We don't want to talk about this anymore. Let's move on to something else. She said, we need to talk about this. We need to talk about it. And he cursed her out, her own sibling, because he was being made uncomfortable by discussion of racism and white privilege and Black Lives Matter. Now, what I'm telling you is this. We are just scratching the surface. All your listeners out there who say, I don't know, I don't understand. I'm telling you, we got to have some tough conversations, and we got to make a resolve that we're going to take some tough actions, because 401 years of this crap is enough. It is. And you never heard me talk like this before, okay? I'm not angry. I'm a 77-year-old man.
I think there's one time, Bill. I think there was one time. I think when Letitia Parson was murdered, I think that was it.
Well, you heard me say I was pissed off.
I did. I remember that.
And people say, oh, Mayor, you should be using that kind of term. How are you going to? Well, anyway, that's a separate story. But Evan, the two Justins and Victoria, if you understand the point I'm trying to make, yes. But I don't want people to spend all that energy talking about naming a street, renaming a street, or renaming a city, because that is totally non-productive. I want to know what's going on in those cities. I want to know what's happening on those streets. I want to know if people can live on those streets and if there are any barriers to preventing them from living on those streets. I want to know if people can work on those streets. And that's what we're trying to remove, is the barriers, the obstruction to progress. Not somebody's comfort level about whether Nathaniel Rochester owned slaves in 1820.
Well, that's Bill Johnson, a former mayor of Rochester and co-chair of the recently formed Commission on Racial Equity. Victoria Schmidt is with us, a local historian, and Justin Barron, a historian who is the chair of the History Department at SUNY Geneseo. Justin Murphy is a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle, whose outstanding work in the Democrat and Chronicle this week is a must-read. It's on the history of Nathaniel Rochester, but also so many others who are interconnected to Rochester, people like Carol and Fitzhugh and Charles Williamson and so many others who, owned enslaved people, made a lot of money off it, and had the kind of history that often doesn't get reported or recorded or passed down. But it's real. And the question then becomes, what do you do about it? Well, Bill Johnson just made the case for doing real reform work now, and he doesn't see renaming parks or streets or even towns part of that. He sees that as a distraction. We're talking about that and a lot more after our only break of the hour right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we're joined by Bruce Jacobs, author of the book Race Manners. His work explores how to have civilized, candid, and meaningful dialogues about race. He'll be giving a presentation for the Harley School next week, but first, he joins us to talk about anti-racism in today's political climate and during the coronavirus pandemic. That's Monday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So some feedback that Justin Murphy collected in his piece regarding what to do, and maybe some dissent to what you just heard from Mayor Johnson regarding name changes. Justin, I know you talked to Howard Eagle, who is a longtime anti-racism activist. He believes that changing names, even the city of Rochester's name, sends a clear message that we're serious about confronting racism. Some of the founders of the current movement from an organization, Free the People Rock, you talked to Stephanie Vargas, who told you, quote, yes, do that, change the names, but also defund the police and make other systemic fixes. That's just a cosmetic fix, changing names, one that needs to be done, but it's not the be-all, end-all. And Justin, if you could you share what Van White had to say, the president of the Rochester School Board, regarding school number 3 as well?
Yeah, he said that he thinks that when children walk into a school building, you know, there are some
some schools in RCSD that are named after. There's a Martin Luther King School, there's a Roberto Clemente School. Van was, you know, kind of instrumental in renaming the Anna Murray Douglas Academy. And he said when a child walks up and sees a name he's familiar with, I think that makes a difference. And I can say from experience, last year I was at Anna Murray Douglas Academy one day. And, of course, up there they not only named that school, but the libraries for Frederick Douglass, the rec center, they have all the murals. And I walked with the kids around the building. They had research questions that they had done in the classroom, and they went around and, you know, shook his hand that's protruding from the wall there. And it was a very enriching experience for them, not only to learn about Frederick Douglass, but just kind of assimilate what, you know, his life meant for their lives. And so, you know, I take the point that changing, for instance, Charles Carroll School 46, which is in Browncroft, is not a substantive thing on itself. But when you compare that to the Anna Murray Douglas Academy, for instance, really the best case scenario is that those kids don't really know who Charles Carroll is. And I don't know, he's some white guy, maybe he founded the city, and we'll just go past that and do whatever it is we're doing. So in that sense, it kind of represents, I think, a missed opportunity. You know, one really interesting thing that Justin Barron told me that didn't make it into the story was about the iconography before the American Revolution and how, like, the first round of statue knockdowns that we had.
Justin, can you, Justin Barron, can you expand on that?
Yeah, so there were statues to King George III, and they were taken down by patriots. And as a symbol of the changes that the new country was going through. And I don't think anybody laments the fact that those statues are not up. And we certainly have not forgotten about monarchy and King George III. So history was not erased when those monuments came down. And actually, the replacing of symbols and other statues and monuments in public spaces should be renewed over time. And so, you know, you want to hold on to your past, but we often need to, I think, choose what that past, what the values from the past that we want to cherish. And I think this gives us an opportunity. And I agree with what Bill Johnson is saying and Justin and Victoria. It can't be just a renaming process. That would be an empty gesture. But if it goes along with, I think it's an and question. You can rename and you can do substantive change about redistribution of incomes and housing, thinking about reparations of some sort. You know, slaveholders often received reparations with the gradual abolition laws, and there hasn't been a reckoning with the emancipation of slaves. They were never compensated in any way, as well as as Bill Johnson said, that the 100 years or so of Jim Crow oppression, often perpetuated by federal and state and local governments. So, you know, monuments have come down in America's past, and they will come down in America's future.
Well, I think a phone call from a listener, which I'm about to take, will help frame a little bit of this idea about what gets taken down, what gets renamed, and why. Tom in Greece on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I don't know if this was already mentioned or not, but Monroe County was named for James Monroe, the fifth president of the United States, who was a slaveholder from Virginia. So are we going to go all the way with the name changing? I don't know. I mean, I can agree with the sentiment of those who think that some name should be changed. Well, anyway, what about Monroe? And after Monroe Avenue was named for him, and, well, actually the Monroe Doctrine while he was the president.
Yeah. So, all right, so Tom, let me just say this before I ask all of our guests to weigh in, but I want to try, at least as I understand it, to frame a few things here. First of all, I'm just a white man with this microphone. I do not have the experience, and, you know, my life has not been impacted in the way that certainly black people have been impacted by monuments, Confederate monuments. I'm not talking about James Monroe, but I'm talking about some of what we've seen, particularly in the American South, but not always the American South. But, you know, sometimes people say, well, what are you going to do? You're going to take down the Washington Monument? You're going to take down, you're going to change the name Washington, D.C., Monroe County? I guess what I would say is I am always open to listening to people who are hurting. I try to remove myself from a little bit from this and listen. Now, Bill Johnson's got a point of view. We've heard Van White, so many others. I want to listen. What I find maybe an interesting way of framing this is, whether it's a statue or the name of a city or the name of a park, does it have that honor because of a person's racism or in spite of it? And frankly, the Confederate monuments are monuments because of racism. And they ought to be, I mean, I think a lot of people feel that they ought to come down. The notion of, you know, a Washington Monument or the name of the city of Rochester or Monroe County is probably a name in spite of racism. I'm not, again, saying that there shouldn't be a discussion about renaming. But Bill Johnson, does that distinction make sense to you?
I think that yes, but I think that we have separate discussions here. There is a movement to against Confederate memorabilia, flags, statue of their heroes, and the like. And they are justifiably coming down, and they should come down. And then there's another movement that's going on. A high school just got named after John Lewis in Virginia this morning. It was just announced in the Washington Post, either in Fairfax County or if it was a Washington suburb, all right? And the previous name on that school, Robert E. Lee. So the Robert E. Lee High School is now going to become the John Lewis High School. I think we ought to have a protocol where we go back and look at the names that are on the school. Before number 12 school, which all three of my daughters attended, and I lived right just around the corner from that when they were growing up, before it was renamed for Mrs. Douglas, it was James Duffy School number 12, all right? Nobody knew who James Duffy was in the 21st century, but they knew darn well who he was in the early 20th century. He was a very famous person. I think we ought to say those names have served that purpose. They honored somebody in a contemporary fashion. We only have a few buildings that we can put names on. Do we want to go back and put more contemporary names on those buildings to reflect people who've made significant contributions in our community? I think that is an entirely legitimate discussion to have. But when you go down this foxhole of trying to remove every name that's attached to every 19th century person who probably was a slave owner, Jefferson, the man who penned the words, "All men are created equal." He wrote those words, was a slave owner. Not only that, he had a slave mistress. He fathered children by Sally Hemings. We can't change that. But you know what? All of Thomas Jefferson, most of Thomas Jefferson's descendants, white and black, have now accepted that history. The white ones grew up not knowing they had any black relatives, and the black ones, it was a well-kept secret. All right? So now, this in the open, they now are charting their own course. I think we need to allow for that. But this wholesale taking a name down because are we going to shut the Erie Canal down because that 523-mile trench was dug primarily by slaves? No, we're not going to do that. It is a valuable commodity, all right? And while we're on it, there are a lot of people in the 20th century who were segregationists. They didn't own any slaves, but they held some pretty abhorrent viewpoints. So we'll go take Strom Thurmond's name off or something. We'll take George Wallace's name off. I think we ought to have some purpose and some rationale for why we're going through this exercise. But to try to purge history, to cleanse it, that's not history, and that's not productive. And I will tell Howard Eagle and anybody else that to their face, come join me to find solutions for what laws Monroe County need to change, not whether we should change Monroe County's name.
Justin Barron, does the idea... go ahead, Victoria.
It's not just the laws. We have to change. We have to make systemic change. We have to stop having one of the highest child poverty levels in the United States. We have to change that. We have to stop feeding people chemicals instead of real food when we're right in the middle of the most lush, fertile area with all kinds of food available for people. But we have all these crazy systems about how we're going to twist into a pretzel to make the most money and beat the competition. And if we're not willing to face that, we are not going to be able to make real change, because everything is about the almighty dollar. We have hundreds of great leaders here in Rochester. Howard Cole, which is the reason Bill Johnson and I knew each other. We used to get together every year and celebrate his birthday. That man should be as famous as Frederick Douglass. He's a national hero. He recorded, saved every document he could find about African-American history. Published a newspaper that is a treasure chest of African American culture, ideas, philosophy, writing, things, events of the time from their point of view. It's so rich. And he's just one. David Anderson, Elliot Barkley, the prisoner spokesman from Attica, who was so eloquent. The first person that wrote a book about his experiences in jail was from Rochester. His mother is buried in Mount Hope Cemetery. And he foreshadowed the mass incarceration of African American males. There's so much that's centered.
Victoria, just let me jump in, just because your phone's sort of in and out just a little bit there, and I want to make sure we can still hear you. So we'll figure that out. And Justin Barron, I'll just ask you briefly: do you see this debate over renaming? Does it make sense to say we're going to remove whether it's a monument or a name or an honorific of some kind, if that honor comes because of the slavery or in spite of it? Does that framing make sense to you?
It does. There's a clear difference in my mind between the Confederate monuments, which are explicitly white supremacist and represented a traitorous project, the Confederate States of America, compared to other names. My point about renaming has to do with, again, we should be thinking about be more creative about what our values as this community are, and be flexible with coming up with new people, as Victoria was just mentioning, that are not well known and maybe should, being more flexible in how we think about public spaces. And in using this as an opportunity to kind of renew our public spaces. I'm heartened to hear Justin Murphy's story about what the children and Anna Douglas School are doing. Students will understand history in many ways if they're connected to their locality, if they understand that the ground that they're on has a particular history. And when they go to a school where nobody wants to talk about the name of that the school is named after, then you lose that connection to that history. So I think if you want to talk about educating the youth of America to understand that history better, in one way is to really root those students and teach them some of these heroes and some of these movements, and not just from the 19th century, the 20th century as well. This is, I think, a real opportunity to kind of better integrate locality and history. I think we teach a bit too much national history and can do better teaching a more inclusive local history.
Well, I will say Justin Murphy's work is doing a tremendous service to the community, because even if there's disagreement among people in the community about changing names, to Bill Johnson and really all the panel's point earlier, it is important that we get the history correct and that we are not just teaching ourselves a fairy tale. And I think Justin Murphy's work is vital in that regard. And so Bill Johnson, in the last 80 seconds or so as co-chair of this commission now, you know, we heard on this program some of the organizers of Free the People Rock. Iman Abed, Stephanie Vargas, Ashley Gantt, they're talking, Stanley Martin, they're talking about actual abolition of police, full abolition of police, whereas Reverend Lewis Stewart on this program said to them, that is not what black people generally want. We have to have activism that does the work that the people do want, and that we can't lose some of the plot there. Real reform is still possible. Are you thinking at this point, Bill, in our last minute, that there is any sort of consensus that people can arrive at to actually create the kind of progress that you've been talking about?
I don't think there's consensus, but I think there's an opportunity to have that discussion. We will be announcing within the next 2 weeks the full commission. We will be announcing the structure and the work of that commission, and there will be a working group that deals with policing issues. I think everyone, the people you just named, will be invited to come and participate in that discussion, because there is no consensus. We don't come in there with a preconceived agenda. I think these are valuable questions to talk. And as somebody who supervised and oversaw a 750-person police department for 12 years, I know the value of policing, and I would never say there would be no police, all right? Because, unfortunately, if we could say there would be no criminals, then, yes, we don't need any police. So I would ask people to really look forward to the announcement and to and come and engage with us in this very serious discussion about a number of important issues that need to be addressed and systemic changes that need to occur in this community.
Please keep us informed on that, and we'll look forward to having you back here with that, Bill. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, too. Thank you for this
opportunity. Bill Johnston is former mayor of Rochester and co-chair of the commission. And we'll talk to him soon. Justin Barron from SUNY Geneseo, chair of the history department. Thanks for your expertise this hour, Justin. Thanks for making it work.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Victoria Schmidt, thank you for your expertise as a local historian.
Thank you for having me. And thank you, Mayor Johnson. You're amazing.
And Justin Murphy, thanks for the great work. We're looking for a book soon.
It's coming.
Book deadline. Hey, everyone, have a wonderful weekend. And we'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.